agenda a little bit of out of order. I don't have quite of a quorum yet, and we're going to, I want to have more people here for our informational meeting. We will go ahead and do the public hearing on House Bill 2146, do that first. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2146. And we'll have John talk about the bill briefly.
Thank you, Chair Starr and members of the committee. House Bill 2146 creates a new description of pilotage grounds within which certain vessels must be under direction of state licensed pilot. This bill eliminates the current definition in ORS 776.025 regarding 30 fathoms. Katie Iman, as you note, is the chair of the Board of Marine Pilots, and she's out in the hall.
Please, Ted. We could have Katie Iman come up and testify. We're in a public hearing on House Bill 2146. We're really prepared to do this in public. That's fine. If you just want to go to the witness, introduce yourself for the record, and you can talk about the bill.
Thanks,
Representative Starr, Chair of the Committee, and committee members, my name is Katie Iman, and I am the Chair of the Board of Maritime Pilots, and I apologize for being out in the hallway. So the reason I'm here today is to testify on the bill before you. This is a bill that we drafted, or we came up with a concept as response to the new CARISA issue. And what happened in the new CARISA was it was discovered that there is an uncertain definition of the pilotage grounds for the state of Oregon. The current law says that the pilotage grounds have to be within 30 fathoms off the coast of Oregon, which would include the whole coast. Another part of the statute says that a pilot must be on board when a vessel is in the pilotage grounds. And as we know, if a vessel is transiting off of seaside and within 3 miles, we generally don't have a pilot on, we have no pilot available for that transgression, so to speak, in within 30 fathoms of Oregon. So what we decided to do in response to the new CARISA report was to define specific pilotage grounds where you have to have a pilot around each of the ports that use pilots, which are Coos Bay, Newport, and the Columbia River. And in our discussions in our board, we were advised by our Attorney General that the state of Oregon cannot legislate beyond 3 miles. The, as you know, the territorial sea of Oregon extends out for 3 miles, and our Attorney General said you cannot say anything beyond, about anything beyond 3 miles. You just don't have the jurisdiction. The federal can, but the state can't. So, in light of that, we drew boundaries around each of the ports that did not go any further westward than 3 miles, and the legislation you see before you is in line with that restriction based on our attorney's opinion. And yesterday, we understand that the bar pilots of the Columbia River want to extend it out further based on their actual boarding of vessels further out than 3 miles off of the coast of Oregon at the Columbia River. And so what we're asking is that you reschedule this for a hearing, because we definitely want to move this legislation. We want to definitely define it for at least Coos Bay and Newport and the Columbia River, hopefully. And we need to resolve this legal issue as to whether or not we can go further westward than the 3 miles, which our current proposal has, but the bar pilots say is based on erroneous legal opinion and have now given us a brief that says we can go further. And when we get that issue resolved, we'd love to come back to you and then future approval of our proposal to actually physically define the college grounds much more specifically than they are right now.
Great. Are there any questions? No questions. Now, if you can just stay in the room while we have some other folks testify, just in case we want to ask them to come back. That's okay.
Thank you, and I apologize for...
I'd like Mike and Roger Nelson, Columbia River Bar pilot. You can introduce yourself for the record. And
yes, I'm Mike Hagland, Admiralty Counsel for the Columbia River Bar Pilots Association.
And Roger Nelson, Columbia River Bar Pilot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We want to express our overall support for the concept of 2146. We believe that consistent with the report, the final report of the new CARISA Review Committee, that Oregon's pilotage grounds should be more specifically defined. And we have to take responsibility for the fact that we missed the fact that there was a change in the draft of this legislation as it moved through the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots from a line of demarcation we were very comfortable with that is overall consistent with what the bar pilots are doing to this three-mile limit. And as Captain Nelson will explain, if the pilotage grounds just extends out 3 miles, it's actually a reduction of the current state of the law and would not be consistent with the safety practices that are presently employed. My testimony has been reduced to writing and explains the legal authorities that we think make it clear that although the state won't be declaring that it owns the sea beyond 3 miles, we believe the state of Oregon, where it is necessary to implement a safe pilotage system, has the power, like California does and has, to declare a pilotage ground westward into the sea of the mouth of the Columbia River that extends further out to sea. We're hopeful and support Madam Chair Iman's request that there be a postponement of moving this bill. We're supportive of that and are optimistic that at the between now and the next Board of Maritime Pilots meeting on March 20th that we'll be able to work out a mutually agreeable longitudinal line that will work for the bar pilots and does not result in an actual reduction of what the current law is in terms of when a pilot has to be aboard a foreign vessel approaching the Columbia River.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Hagland? Mr. Nelson, do you wish to testify?
Yes, sir. Yes. I'm one of the 20 state-licensed Columbia River Bar Pilots and immediate past president of the Bar Pilots Association. As Mr. Hagland has mentioned, we support this Bill 2146. We've had a little problem with the language, which we didn't see until too late. By way of background, the bar pilots operate or pilot ships over one of the roughest bars in the world. The weather is a culmination of Pacific swell and strong currents coming from the Columbia River. It causes a stretch of very rough water. Historically, Oregon law has defined the Columbia River bar pilotage grounds as extending to open sea in at least 30 fathoms of water, which is generally 5 to 7 miles from shore. In most conditions, it's not possible for the bar pilots to board a vessel in at a 3 mile area because of the weather situation and because of maneuvering characteristics of vessels. Prior to 1999, our practice was to board vessels in the vicinity of the CR buoy, which is approximately 5 nautical miles offshore. Now we have instituted a new boarding system consisting of a helicopter and a fast pilot boat, and we board most vessels 7 to 10 miles offshore in order to get aboard have a conference with the master, exchange information, and get ourselves settled before we actually enter dangerous waters. House Bill 2146 in its current form would contract the pilotage, the bar pilotage ground from the 30-fathom line to the SMARC 3-mile line. And in light of the new Carissa casualty, it is important for the Oregon legislature to look at expanding rather than reducing the area within which state licensed pilots must get aboard foreign ships. We believe the pilotage ground for Columbia River Bar should include a pilotage preparation zone for boarding and disembarking pilots, and it includes a zone from 3 to 12 miles outside. Our Admiralty Council will address the authority of state to regulate these areas, and we have looked at San Francisco Bar, and where the bar pilots in San Francisco board all incoming vessels 11 to 12 miles offshore for safety reasons. First, there's adequate time to check out the capability of the vessel and to conduct a master pilot exchange in which the pilot readies the vessel for the intercrew for the transit or passage into restricted water. And second, the boarding further offshore establishes better traffic separation schemes as part of the collision avoidance. We have similar problems here, and our intention here is to try to keep the vessels separated as much as possible to avoid collisions, to get on board, make sure everyone is prepared for the passage and the master is properly informed of the circumstances of the passage. In summary, Oregon should define its pilotage grounds broadly as necessary to ensure safe pilotage in the Oregon waters. As individuals who handle 4,000 pilotage assignments each year, with a vast majority of the boardings beyond the 3-mile territorial limit, the statute should be consistent with the safest possible practices and procedures.
Thank you for your testimony. Sounds like we need to have some work done on this bill. Are there any questions? Representative Berger?
Yes, I served on the Carissa Review Committee, and this was just one part. One of the things that I just would like to ask you today, and I know you're going to do some work and get together on some of this, but one of the things that bothered me was that the pilot boards at the request of the master of the ship. Isn't that correct? So if it's 3 miles out or 11 miles out, you're still beholden to when you are invited to board? Can you clarify that for me?
Yes. Essentially, the master still controls that ship. In practice, we don't really run into that problem. We do need and actually use the authority to try to keep vessels from, for example, anchoring or approaching too close as they approach a pilot station. And we communicate. The masters are very cooperative, so the situation of one being adamant about coming in, I can't see it occurring. I have seen them, just recently we had one trying to anchor out there, which he did. We got him moved out a little bit further than his original intention. But no, we board at the master's request, but generally that doesn't, I can't even think of instances where that comes up where he says, no, I don't want you.
And in the case of the, a follow-up, please, Mr. Chairman, in the case of the Carissa, where the vessel came in and should have turned and gone back out, it wouldn't have involved the boarding of it, but the anchor being dropped in that kind of storm. So this whole thing of defining, I think, was intertwined with other problems with the new Carissa, and I hope that the pilots are helping look at the overall picture here. I think this is very good to define it, but I hope it's not left just at that.
I think you're right, and to follow on Captain Nelson's comments about this most recent situation, Captain Nelson was actually the pilot aboard the helicopter who noticed that this vessel, which was outbound and apparently had some sort of engine problem, was anchoring just off of, was it Gearhart?
Just to the north of Gearhart.
Just to the north of Gearhart. Within the defined pilotage grounds as they presently exist in the state statute. And that, and then he went and hovered above the ship and said, hey, you should not be anchoring in this area. You need to move out to sea. The helicopter provided that kind of vantage to be able to catch that and make those communications, and the vessel did move further out to sea.
Right.
But one of the reasons that it's important for the ground to be defined in a manner that is broad enough to make sure that we have a safe system is that the law in ORS 776 also provides that within the defined grounds, you can't be moving your ship around without a pilot. So if it comes all the way into 3 miles, we think that would be a mistake. And frankly, you know, we've contributed to the fact that this wasn't caught earlier in the process of this language moving through the Oregon State Board of Maritime Pilots. We're confident we can work it out, but it is important, and it gives the pilot some legislative and legal authority to say, you are not supposed to be in that zone, and it should be reasonably wide.
All right. Thank you very much. I concur with exactly what you said.
Ma'am, I'd like to say one thing. Predating the new Carissa, we looked at this problem, and we have made our thrust more with hardware than anything else, and we now have a radio system that we can speak to the vessels about 5 hours, at least 5 hours out before they arrive at the station. We can be talking to them, communicating about when and how and where they'll be boarded. We have faster equipment now, much faster equipment, including the helicopter and a fast boat. We can move to them, move farther offshore quickly if we get changes in ETAs and things like that. We are now looking at coastal radar system for tracking vessels as they approach the coast and being able to advise them by radio.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. As a result of the economic state in Coos Bay, the Columbia pilots have inherited one of our best pilots, Stephen Woods, and he was the person that boarded the new Carissa and was the first one on. An excellent, excellent man.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Haglund and Captain Nelson, you know, it's been my honor to be a part of the company who supplies your helicopter transport, for having retired after 24 years from that company, and appreciate what you do. I'm wondering if, have you, what has brought this about? Have there been complaints or penalties? What happens if you are going beyond the 3 miles? I mean, is there some speed penalty? I mean, safety has to be always first.
It really, I think, is the state's legal territorial limit is 3 miles from the shoreline. And I think in the process of how this revision of Section 1 came together, it was originally a longitudinal line in the early drafting process that we were comfortable with that was out approximately where they're boarding now, 7-8 miles offshore. And then because of, I think, a concern by the legal counsel of the board that we can't be extending our grounds beyond our territory, the 3 mile territorial sea showed up in this language. And we think that if it gets a closer look from a legal precedent standpoint, we're hopeful that the Attorney General who serves the board will be convinced that it can be where it is consistent with the current practice of the bar pilots, which is designed to have a safe system and actually promote boarding further offshore, which is a worldwide trend. There's more and more boarding further off in order to achieve the safety benefits Captain Nelson testified to.
Follow-up, please.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Haglund, Captain Nelson. So this is just venture we're operating in compliance with the law, but what we need is a safety factor in all of your operations, right? I mean, it's great to have rules, but if they're not safe, I mean, and weather conditions change, and so what we're really asking for is an amendment that allows us to operate safely, and it has to be in the judgment of those conducting the operation. Would you agree?
Yes.
And for places like San Francisco, what do they do? Apply for an exemption from the federal government to be able to go out 12 miles? I mean, what is this green tape or blue tape or red tape that we
there's
have
no,
to do
there's
to
no
be safe in what we do?
Yeah, there's no process of seeking an exemption. It's just a matter of declaring what your pilotage grounds are. And in California, they've declared them to be eastward of a designated buoy, which happens to be 11 to 12 miles offshore, and they call the area out there a precautionary area, which is designed to promote safe practices for that system. I also know that in other ports, Houston being an example, the boarding occurs 4.5 miles off the coast of Texas, and they're in the midst of deepening their ship channel in Houston, and I learned yesterday that once that's complete, the end of next year, they'll be boarding all the vessels 6 miles offshore.
So last question, please, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hagelin and Captain Nelson, when we need to even go further out, then we'll be, you know, prescribed in this bill. Can we do so under the auspice of safety? I mean, will you have that right as pilots to declare this was an emergency and we needed to move further out, so we don't have to continue to keep doing this and move one more mile? Or I'm just curious. I mean, not knowing conditions, every time you have to have a change out of Coos Bay or Newport, you'll have to come in and ask for permission to go out a little further?
Well, the reality is that all of the bar pilots have unlimited federal licenses, so even though the actual pilotage grounds, where I guess the real legal effect of declaring the pilotage grounds to be a certain zone is that it's illegal for a foreign ship to be there without a pilot. There's nothing inappropriate with bar pilots going even further to board a vessel with Evergreen's helicopter. Many of these ships are boarded 10 miles out to sea, and there's no problem with that, no exemption required. We're just concerned about the scope of the area within which ships have to have a pilot.
Okay.
Thank you both very much for your testimony. Nick Discombe, Captain Brown, Kevin Davis. Clearly the bill will be, there'll be some additional measures brought in the bill. We'll have the bill back, so if we can.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and we will try to be brief this morning in light of what has just transpired for you in the last moments. For the record, my name is Dave Fiscom. I'm here representing the Columbia River Pilots. With me to my right is Captain Steve Brown, who is the president of the Columbia River Pilots, and to his right is Kevin Davis, attorney for the pilots, who also represents the pilots in Coos Bay and Yaquina Bay. We're here this morning to support House Bill 2146 insofar as it applies to those two groups of pilots, the Columbia River pilots as well as the ones to the south in Coos Bay and Newport. We've just learned yesterday and today of the concerns that just been expressed to you, and we understand that the Board of Maritime Pilots will be looking at this, and we have no difficulty, but I think it is important for you to know for the record where we stand on this issue. And so, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'll turn to my colleagues on the right, and they can explain where we are on the bill from the standpoint of our groups.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Steve Brown, president of the Columbia River Pilots. The Columbia River Pilots is an organization of 46 licensees of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots who are authorized to provide services to ocean-going vessels transiting the Columbia and Willamette River pilotage. The state licenses held by COLRIP members for the Columbia and Willamette River pilotage ground, which is currently defined in statute as extending from the head of navigation on those rivers downstream to the lowermost dock or wharf at the port of Astoria. The law requires most vessels to hire a river pilot to help navigate over the pilotage ground and imposes on licensees certain rights and responsibilities with respect to pilotage on those waters. Vessels for which pilotage is compulsory are subject to substantial penalties for failure to have a pilot aboard while underway on the pilotage ground, and licensees are likewise subject to penalties should they provide services on waters for which they are not licensed. The lower end of the Columbia and Willamette River pilotage ground overlaps with the upper end of the Columbia River bar pilotage ground. The different group of licensees, the Columbia River bar pilots are authorized to help navigate vessels from sea inbound to the area in the Columbia River where the job is handed off to a coal rip member. The inland reach of the bar pilotage ground is defined as the uppermost dock or wharf at the port of Astoria. Thus, there is an overlap between the river and the bar pilotage grounds so that when between the uppermost and the lowermost docks at the port of Astoria, either the bar pilot or the river pilot may exercise their licenses privileges. The overlap allows an area where the pilotage duties may be handed off from the bar pilot to the river pilot for inbound vessels or from the river pilot to the bar pilot for outbound vessels. The exchange of pilots almost always happens while the vessels are underway and the vessels travel some distance during the time it takes for the exchange to occur. The problem is no one knows exactly what is meant in ORS 776.025, where the reference is made to the uppermost and lowermost docks at the port of Astoria. There are no docks or wharves that are commonly understood to be the uppermost or lowermost such structures at the port of Astoria. In fact, it is not known whether the docks and the wharves referred to were meant to be were meant to be those operated by the port or those that are located within the port district, whether public or private. COLRIP supports the definitions proposed by the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots for the area of overlap between the lowermost point on the river pilotage ground and the uppermost point on the bar pilotage ground. The boundaries proposed by the board are described by lines of longitude so that they may be easily located on any chart. The lines of longitude selected are generally in keeping with the current descriptions as they are located in the vicinity of Astoria. Also, the lines selected by the board reflect both current and potential future operational needs of pilots and vessels. For example, the upstream boundary for the bar pilotage ground would be just upstream from Tongue Point, so that if a vessels ever again start docks at Tongue Point, they would be able to navigate there from sea with just the bar pilots and not also require the hiring of river pilots. Similarly, vessels proceeding downstream under the supervision of river pilots are sometimes asked to go to berths in Astoria. That requires that such vessels go downstream past Astoria, turn around at Young's Bay, and then proceed back upstream against the current for greater control when approaching the docks. The lower boundary for the pilotage ground proposed by the board is the west side of Young's Bay, which would allow for such maneuvering by river pilots without the need to also involve a bar pilot. Additionally, there is ample distance between the proposed upper and lower boundaries for the overlap of the pilotage ground. The exchange between the river and the bar pilot would therefore take place with plenty of room and time to spare for safe and orderly transition of duties and exchange of information. Columbia River pilots recommend the board's proposed boundaries for the Columbia and the Willamette River pilotage ground and the proposed upstream boundary for the Columbia River bar pilotage ground be adopted. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Davis, do you have...
I had nothing further than that, but I'd be happy to help answer any questions, and in particular with respect to Coos Bay and Yucuna Bay. If we don't have a pilot here from Coos Bay or Yucuna Bay to give testimony, but those pilots are satisfied with the descriptions, the specific descriptions that have been proposed by the board for those grounds. The situation is a little bit different in those locations than it is at the mouth of the Columbia River. The 30-fathom line is much closer and nearer to shore at those places than it is at the mouth of the Columbia River. So
they're comfortable with the line that has been described. It's about 3 miles off, and that works for them.
Very good. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. I would expect that the interested parties will work cooperatively to find some amendments that will satisfy all the parties. We'll bring those back, and we'll bring this bill back at that time. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2146. I'd like to, at this minute, open up a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures. Members, you have at your spot a stack of LC drafts. What we'll do is open a work session, then
that's right.
John will briefly talk about each one of them, kind of the summary of each bill, and I'd like to have these introductions done in block.
They didn't say a word, did they? No.
With that, we'll open a work session on for the purpose of introduction of committee measures. And if John will briefly give a summary of each one.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, you have before you 9 LC drafts to introduce as committee measures today. The first one is LC 2934-35. It relates to transportation finance study. LC 3133, it relates to the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund. LC 3134 relates to Safety Education Fund eligibility fee. We have LC 3135 relates to the distribution of motor vehicle code book. You have LC 3136 relates to approval of a motor vehicle accident prevention course. You have LC 3149 relates to fees for utility work along highways. You have before you LC 3508 relates to highway signs. LC 3622 relates to an agricultural transportation task force. And last but not least, you have LC 3779, and should state to you that most of these committee bills are from the Attorney General's letter of guidance in terms of remedy, legislative remedy.
The chair would entertain a motion to introduce the following LC drafts as committee measures: LC 2935, LC 3133, LC 3134, 3135, 3136, 3149, 3508, 3622, and 3779.
So made.
Representative Krupp moves that we introduce those LC drafts pre-mentioned as committee measures. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Close the work session. And we will open the informational meeting for the purpose of having an update on Senate Bill 1334 from last session. First, I'd like to have John kind of just brief the committee a little bit of history on the Senate bill.
Thank you, Chair Starr, and members of the committee. A little bit of background on Senate Bill 1324, which was passed in the 99 legislative session. First of all, this bill is the final of the 10 bills that were became known as part of the Transportation Comprehensive Package. And many of these bills were new efficiency or accountability bills to improve the operations of ODOT and to increase efficiency and accountability. Senate Bill 1324, I had the privilege of working with parties involved before you today, with the exception of Andrea Fogg. Dave Berenberg was the lobbyist or representative for the Oregon League during that last session. And the purpose of this bill was there was over $500 and some million, roughly, that is allocated each biennium to the league, to the cities and counties from the state revenue gas tax highway fund. And there seemed not to be a lot of accountability, according to the legislative body. And I must say that it was a very good, constructive, and cooperative relationship in working with the league and the associated counties, because they want to be more accountable and they want to submit to you the initial report for the first time that was in this legislation, to submit to you the report of the expenditures for the state gasoline revenue tax. And that's pretty much what they've come to do today.
Very good. Andrea Fogg and Bill Tinhollow.
Thank you.
morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties.
And I'm Andrea Fogg, representing the League of Oregon Cities. This morning, Bill and I are here, as Mr. Leon mentioned, to talk with you about Senate Bill 1324 that passed last session. In the handout that you've been given, the categories that we are going to report on are listed in that handout. Basically, we're going to talk with you about the use of road funds in counties and cities. Local government receives approximately 40% of state highway funds. Roughly 24% of those funds go to the counties and 15% go to cities. With those funds, the counties establish county road funds and the cities establish city street funds. Now, we are constitutionally required to spend those funds on roads or related road activities. The State Highway Fund, I want to point out, is one source of revenue, basically. There are other sources of revenue that are mixed with the county road funds and the city street funds, but those come from the local governments. Local governments raise over half of their road and street funds locally, and so those funds are then used with state highway funds only for the purposes of roads and road uses. We are basically held to the same standards as state highway funds with any funds that we use on road or road-related projects. We are also audited annually, and cities and counties have been given really good marks on those audits, I can tell you. Also, our city and county officials are held personally liable for any misappropriation of funds. So I can tell you that it's important to them that those funds are spent appropriately. There are some examples for you also in your packet of the various types of construction and expansion projects, repair and preservation, and also operations and maintenance to give you some idea of some of those purposes, the road and road-related activities the funds are spent on. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bill so he can go through some of the county funds.
Thank you, Andrea. Again, for the record, Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. We are going to report to you today on the seven items that were identified in the legislation that Mr. Leon was talking about earlier. It was Senate Bill 1324 last session. On the first page, you have those categories. We're going to provide you more information than just expenditures. We want to talk to you about where money comes from and how it is expended. Now, I would just add one piece of information with regard to what Ms. Fogg was indicating, and that is that if any of you are interested in viewing either a county or a city audit report to check on the status of those, we are required to file those in the Secretary of State's office. So city and county audits are available to the public in the Secretary of State's office, the Audits Division. As we go through our discussion with you this morning, I'd like just to draw your attention to the second page, because we'll be talking about these categories and wanted to give you a little bit of information on what we mean when we're saying construction and expansion, expenditures or repair and preservation, operation and maintenance. What does that really mean out on the ground? And this third page will give you that kind of information with a definition and examples of what is meant by each category. And then if you would turn with me to the pages following the blue insert, which is the county road funds, I would like to take just a few minutes to present that information for your consideration, and then Ms. Fogg will follow with the city information, and we'll certainly be open for any questions from the committee. On the table that we've provided for county road funds, this is for the fiscal year July 1st, 1999 through June 30th, 2000. The most recent completed fiscal year. And just to remind you, cities and counties operate on a fiscal year, not on a biennium as the state does. So this is the reason why we report on a fiscal year, and all counties, and I believe all cities, operate on the July 1, June 30th fiscal year. The top half of that table provides you information, probably more information than you care about, but information on revenues that flow into the county road fund. And as Ms. Fogue indicated, it's more than just state highway funds. We have local revenues that flow to the county road fund, and we also have federal funds that flow into the road fund in addition to the state highway fund revenues. The lower portion of that first table basically sets out the seven categories that Senate Bill 1324 directs counties and cities to report on. And so we have set out here expenditures for this fiscal year for construction and expansion, repair and preservation, operation and maintenance, bike paths, administration, payments to other governments, and other payments such as bonds and debt service. If following that page is the first pie chart that we provide for you, basically showing for the counties where our revenues come from in major categories. You see that 49% of our funds come from the state, and we'll see in a moment that the vast majority of that is from the state highway fund. We also receive 32% of our revenues from local sources, various kinds of local sources, 19% from federal funds. The next page, then we break, the next three pages, we break each of those categories down. Local revenues, what do they represent as far as revenue receipts to the county road fund, state revenues, and federal revenues? So you see the vast variety of local revenues that flow into the county road fund, property taxes, county road fund receipts, local, in a county's case, we do have some local gas tax receipts. Two counties have local gas taxes in Oregon, Multnomah County and Washington County, as well as other fees to the road fund. Now, as Ms. Fogue indicated, again, as those monies come into the county road fund or the city street fund, they take on, if you will, the color of the constitutionally dedicated state highway funds. So these funds then become dedicated for roads and bridges of the county or the city, as the case may be. The second, the next pie chart indicates state revenues, and as I pointed out earlier, the majority of that, 93% of those state revenues come from the state highway fund. That's the revenues from the current gas tax, the weight mile tax, and vehicle registration fees that flow to the counties and cities. The last pie, or the next, pardon me, the next last pie chart, the last pie chart on revenues for counties deals with federal revenues. And the vast majority of federal revenues for counties are federal timber receipts, or what has been historically a share in timber harvest revenue from U.S. forest lands that lie in 31 of the 36 counties. I think, as you probably know, 52% of the state of Oregon is owned by the federal government. And in these cases, there are have historically been revenues that flow to the counties from these federal revenue receipts. Harvest on these federal lands has pretty much diminished, and what we find now is federal payments to counties to replace a portion of those funds, and At another time, we would be happy to talk to you about the federal legislation that passed last year that provided counties a six-year safety net in this area of federal timber receipts. A disaster relief reimbursement is another very important area of federal funds, as well as county sharing in a portion of federal aid dollars. The last page for counties deals with the expenditures, again using the seven categories that we talk about. I just point out to you that if you combine basically the administration, operation, maintenance, preservation, more than half of those funds are dedicated for just maintaining, in the county's case, the 27,000 miles of county roads that we have today, trying to keep up with the deterioration that is occurring on those roads, and not doing a very good job of that, because we find that both pavements and gravel road conditions continue to deteriorate due to a lack of revenue to expend on those programs. So let me stop at that point, and I will turn the microphone back to Ms. Fogue and allow her to do the city street.
Thank you.
Can we just...
You want to hold?
Yeah, let's just wait.
Okay.
Andrew, talk, and then...
Again, Mr. Chair, committee members, Andrew Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities. Basically, Bill did a great job of giving you the run-through. There's not a whole lot that's different for cities. Again, the information is laid out in the same basic categories. And as we begin to go through the charts, again, over half of the road revenues are raised locally, and about 42% of city road revenues come from the state, and again, a federal portion. On the next chart, I would like to point out that although pie charts are great, they don't capture everything. So we actually do have some local gas taxes, but it's a very small amount. It's roughly $700,000 statewide. There are four cities with a local gas tax. So that's not accurate that it's 0%, but it's it was not enough to register with our pie chart. The actual number for you is, again, laid out in the specific information located in the first chart. As you can see from the state revenues, a large portion of those are, the state highway funds. Our federal funding situation is a little different than the counties in that, of course, we receive a small portion of timber receipts, and that was a question previously asked by this committee, and basically it's maybe a handful of cities statewide that have an individual agreement with their county. But our federal funds come from housing and urban development and some other areas, but on the whole, a much smaller amount. And then the last chart, again, basically shows that a bit of our dollars are spent on operations and maintenance, repair and preservation. It's important to note that when you're talking about construction expansion or modernization with cities, it's not as visible necessarily. It's curbs and sidewalks and signals and synchronizing signals and those types of things when you think of modernization dollars with cities. And so it's not necessarily a new road that's being constructed or an overpass, something like that. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. I think there are some. I've got one. The construction and expansion at the city level,
mm-hmm.
that include developer-built roads and new subdivisions?
Well,
credited to the total at all, or is that separate? The subdivision gets built, the developer pays, builds the roads.
I know at the county level, Mr. Chair, for the record, Bill Penhollow, and I think probably the same. That is not included as a receipt or expenditure, the road fund, or credited, but it would become a part of the asset that is owned by the city or the county.
Thank Thank you.
That is correct. I John Osho and myself worked on these numbers, and so that's correct. Those aren't included there.
Great, thank you. And for the committee, it's good to note that this is for the cities, that were greater than or more than 5,000. This is only cities less than 5,000 on the advisory report.
Yes, I apologize. If I could note that, it was a small note at the bottom of your chart, but I should have mentioned that. Cities over 5,000 reported, but basically what we were able to do was determine that that's 89% the cities that reported, and we didn't get all of them over 5,000, are 89% of the population represented across the state. And what we did then was we extrapolated these numbers to get to the 100%. So it is... so you see the numbers that are representative for city population across the state.
You confuse me. In these numbers, are there information in these numbers that represent cities less than 5,000?
Mr. Chair, there was a small portion of information that was reported for cities under 5,000, but it was very, very small.
So you calculated the numbers to cover everybody?
Correct. Yes.
And Devlin had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is probably more true for counties and cities, but it's true for both, actually, in a way. Mr. Penhall, the picture of county revenues, could it be perceived as somewhat kind of deceptive in the sense that many of those revenues are not commonly shared revenues? I mean, the property taxes might be a couple of counties that are utilizing property taxes, local gasoline taxes. I know of two counties. I don't know if there's a third or fourth. And obviously, some counties receive significant timber receipts and other counties don't. So, I mean, it's not as if this revenue was available on a per capita basis for every county or anything in reference to their road miles or anything else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin. You are correct. You look at those property taxes, a good example. Not all the counties levy a county road property tax. Some do. The local gas tax, as I indicated earlier, two counties have local gas taxes.
Washington
and Multnomah County. Most of your urban counties have development fees, but not all of the counties. Federal forest revenues, as you indicated, are not equally spread. There are 31 of the 36 counties that receive that source of revenue. And bonds, again, bonding for road improvements is just a few counties that use that as a tool. This, we put it all together and present it as a package, and you're so right, it isn't equally distributed.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrea, you noted that five cities have local gas taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Five cities are those?
Actually, I believe there are four. I will double-check for you, but the Dalles, Woodburn, Pendleton, Tillamook, and I will check and see if there's a fifth for you.
Mr. Chair.
The Dalles, Woodburn, and what was the other?
Tillamook, Pendleton, Woodburn, and the Dalles. Mr. Chair. Those are smaller cities. And in the Portland area, we have the Multnomah County tax. In your cases, has Portland considered a gas tax just by itself previously, or, you know, larger cities have considered this?
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm not certain of the history with that with the city of Portland, but I would be happy to check on that and get back to you.
Okay. Portland has a $10 a month stormwater fee, of which they calculate 65% servicing the water, stormwater off roads. Is that type of transportation expense included in your calculations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I do not believe, it just depends whether that's represented in their road funds, and I think that city specifically, and I'd be happy to get back to you on that information.
What city was that?
Portland. Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the federal funds, do we have to match those to get those, or is that a combination of some match, or is that net?
Mr. Chair, representatives, on the federal funds that are identified here do not require a match. Those funds are outside of the city and county budget. We are eligible for surface transportation program funds, which do require a match, but those are administered on behalf of cities and counties by ODOT, the exception to that being in the metro area where Metro is responsible for that. But the federal funds that we've identified here do not require a match.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Nelson?
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and Mr. Penhall, Ms. Fogue, and...
excuse me. I'm John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. I was primary number cruncher.
O'Shell?
O'Shell.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate this report, and I will ask for the audits. I'm assuming the audits are by county and cities that are available today and just in time for a 2 o'clock commissioners meeting in my county, and so it's very, this is great. When we talk about these various funds and we see an interest income, what is this based on, if you please?
Interest income would be interest earned on those revenues that as they are collected or as they are held in reserve. Now, a number of cities and counties have both what we call obligated reserves and contingency reserves. Obligated reserves are important carrying the city and county cash flow situation through from one fiscal year to another, recognizing that the fiscal year comes right in the middle of the summer season when much of the road work and bridge work can be done, as well as the fact that some of these revenues are not received on an annual basis. For instance, property taxes don't come in until November, so you have to have some cash flow. So there are both interest earned on revenues upon receipt as well as interest earned on their reserves.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Penhall, are these funds managed by the city, each individual city and county, or state management?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, they are managed by each of the 36 counties and the 240 cities.
One more question, please. Thank you. Further, when you look through this information, I'm trying to relate it by looking at the Senate Bill 1324, and Mr. Leon can tell me, I may be looking differently, but these are different categories than are listed here. Previously had categories called public improvement, just the maintenance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think they are the same categories. They're just listed in the statute alphabetically, in alphabetical order, and I think we've captured all of those seven categories in the reports that we provided here.
So I'm going to answer that. Just some background, Representative Nelson. Originally in statute, you have the category of maintenance you're referring to and public improvements. The legislative body wanted a little bit more itemized breakdown, and so then you have the following categories that were created in the bill, which is administration, bicycle path, and the rest.
So I can assume that these amendments were adopted in this bill?
That's why it is A engrossed.
May I continue, please?
Yes.
Is there, Mr. Chair and Mr. O'Shall and Mr. Penhall and Ms. Fogue, are there a specific category of safety is missing? And I'm deeply concerned about that, and that it's very impacting. For example, in my county, in Highway 18, that impacts. And I wonder where I would find that category of safety enhancements.
Identify yourself.
This is John O'Shell again. We produced these reports off of another report that the counties and the cities are all required to turn to the state, and there are quite a few other categories within that report that we combined for this report, basically because we felt like we probably should submit it to you in the categories requested. However, the information you are interested in is available in those reports. If you would let us know what specific items you want,
right,
within certain limitations, we could produce those for you.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I see, just looking at some of the categories that safety and traffic maintenance, some of that's included under the operations and maintenance category. So, again, those have been incorporated into the overall categories, but happy to get you whatever specifics you'd like.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I will contact you. Very important, I think, everywhere, and certainly in my county. And Representative Zahner and Brown County, which we all share to some degree. And last question, please.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, the monies, for example, collected from Multnomah County, or the dollars collected from Multnomah County and what was the other one? Washington County, so in the county gas tax,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Does that stay totally with those counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, no. What you need to do is refer to the expenditure table that we have for counties. In the case of Multnomah County and City of Portland, Multnomah County shares a portion of its state highway funds and local gas taxes with City of Portland, so that payments to other governments that's identified there, $33.662 million, a portion of that would be a payment that flows from Multnomah County on to the City of Portland.
And in the case of the other county, please follow up, does that stay, you know, absolute with Washington County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I would need to look at the material. I think there are dollars flowing in probably all county situations to the cities, but I don't have the numbers here. That's something that we could provide you as well.
Yep, the dollars raised within the county stay in the county. Washington County gas tax revenues aren't transferred to Yamhill County, Columbia County.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Devlin,
I think there's also another aspect of this, too, is that Multnomah County's gas tax is 3 cents. Washington County's gas tax is 1 cent. So the difference in revenue raised is substantial.
Representative Berger,
yes, Bill, I don't want to open up a big discussion here, but on the federal timber receipts, you referred to the legislation. There's a certain percentage of that goes to schools, passes through schools from the counties, and the rest is for county roads. There's a lot of discussion in this building about other ways of dividing that money. Are the counties going to hold fast for that money to be used on county road systems in the counties that do have, did you say 31 of the 36 counties?
Correct.
Actually have the federal receipts? However, some counties have much larger forests than others. So my question back to that is, what percentage goes to the school, and will the counties hold with getting this money for county roads in which it is due?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you are correct. Under the new federal act, the allocations have changed slightly. What they have done is to take the revenues from the three highest years of from 1986, I think, through 1999, and that becomes then the base amount that comes to Oregon.
then the receipts that come to Oregon, the federal law now says first that 15 to 20% will be set aside for special enhancements that benefit the forest or expenses incurred in providing services to the forest. Now that's determined by each county. So then you have, after that, 80 to 85% that flows on to the county, if you will. And then Oregon law says that of that 80 to 85%, 75% goes to the county road fund and 25% goes to the county school fund. And in passing this legislation, our congressional delegation was very clear in their expectation of how these monies should flow to roads and schools of those counties. And so, yes, we will be holding to the position that's in the current statute, that 75% of that go to roads and 25% through the county school fund to the schools in those counties.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pinhall, would do the timber harvest revenue fund, the receipts stay in the 31 counties from which the timber came? I'm concerned because the school funds seem not to be going to do the same thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it is my recollection, and maybe we need to check the federal law, but the federal law has historically said that the monies are to be used in the counties of where the forests lie for roads and schools. So though at least those federal dollars, yes, flow back to the counties wherein the forest lies. So to give you an example, Wallowa-Whitman National Forests are up in the northeastern part of the state. They would not be used in Yamhill County or in Marion County. They will go back to those counties. Your county, I believe, shares in revenue from the Siuslaw Forest. So, yes, that they would go back to the counties where the forests are located.
Last question, please.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Pinhall, are you aware of $1.2 billion that is owed us from 1960s from the federal government for timber receipts that have not been collected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, no, not that number per se. I would be interested in talking to you about that. I am aware of the fact that since 1990, since the policy on harvesting of timber on national forests was changed and the harvest started to decline, counties to the road fund have lost about $500 million in revenue that we would have projected to flow to the county had the policies continued as they were prior to 1990. But that's an interesting number. I'd like to talk with you about that.
I would appreciate that, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I did pass that on to Mr. Stinson, and I hope we pursue that, and I've also spoken to the governor about it. So we just need to verify if there was a trade-off of some sort, but right now we don't have that answer. Could your help us if we'll just put it on our wish list, and I appreciate
thank you.
Your research.
Bring it to my attention.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To the Information Committee. I'll just say a couple of announcements before we adjourn for today. Friday's meeting, again, it's an opportunity to see some MoDOT projects in motion, in action, in construction. We're leaving from the Capitol building at 8 o'clock. The front, the Court Street side of the Capitol, 8 o'clock. We'll be back in time for session at 11. If you live in Portland and want to catch up with us in Portland, you can catch us at the Crown Plaza, Cruise Way 217 area there. At the entrance there, we can pick you up, meet you there if you don't want to drive down to Salem. Also, just a heads up on next week's committee schedule. On Monday, we're having the Efficiency Committee come and talk to us a little bit about some of the things that they've done. And Director Quinnikin will be before our committee on Monday. It's her last chance before the committee as Director of ODOT. I encourage the committee to be on time. We want to get some things accomplished in that meeting. Wednesday and Friday of next week, there will be no committee meeting scheduled. So you have some free time on your Wednesday and Friday mornings.
Please don't tell the lobbyists.
And we are currently scheduled through March 7th. So keep a tally on our agenda, bills that are coming up. Try to take a look at those bills, talk to the lobby that are interested, the state agencies that are affected, so we can continue to move forward on what we are trying to accomplish to assess in transportation. And is there anything else? And just another quick announcement. We're planning a field trip and actually outside of Salem, public hearing and testimony the 22nd and 23rd of March in the Dalles and Central Oregon in the Redmond area. We'll have an opportunity to have public testimony related to transportation issues in those areas. Some of our friends from Eastern Oregon think that they get short shrift sometimes. So we want to go to the Dalles and have the opportunity for them to drive down I-84 and talk to them. There will be other committee meetings, hearings, and other parts of the state as we can get them organized and find monies to fund the travel. So, Representative Devlin.
Well, we have Representative Plyer.
I don't know if it's big enough plane.
I can get one.
All right. The Columbia Bar pilot.
We can certainly look at that. Is there anything else, committee members? With that, we're adjourned.